There are schools of thought that believe we have unlimited scope and possibilities for making decisions. The truth is that our scope is somehow restricted and we have less room. It is therefore key that we engage in innovative decision-making to optimize opportunities in our business and personal lives. We need to understand our decision-making skills as individuals and organizations. This will enable us to adjust accordingly to the constant changing environment. Question: if Jesus had taught at Harvard Business School on these related issues, what would he have to say? My name is Tinuke Akinbulamo. Welcome to today's episode of the If Jesus Taught at Harvard Business School podcast. In today's session, we have Adio Jomo, a management consultant in the consulting, advisory, and training space, concluding the discussion around exploring the frameworks required to identify business opportunities. In the last episode, we looked at the decision-making framework and components that will enable an individual or organizations to make optimum and quality choices when it comes to managing the life cycle around identifying business opportunities. We shall be concluding the session by discussing the frameworks and the components required to deliver the products and services supporting the business opportunity to the market. This framework is called the delivery framework.
Now, last week, we looked at the topic identifying business opportunities, and we looked at something called a decision-making framework. In other words, what we discussed last week was that what are the decisions or what are the components of a decision-making framework which enables us to exploit opportunities as they come? Because one of the facts that we quoted last week was that opportunities do not come in a structured manner. So when these opportunities do come, we have to be prepared to exploit them. So in other words, we need to have some form of framework in place that we can benchmark against the opportunity. Do we exploit this opportunity or do we let this opportunity go? Which is a good benchmark to start today, because now not every opportunity has to be exploited. And Jesus has advocated this in his word, because there's a particular scripture which says, where he tells the people that he hasn't been called to the Gentiles. In other words, what Jesus was saying is that, you know, I've been called to address the needs, the product needs of a particular market segment. So you can see that sometimes opportunities may come your way, but you need to be able to say, or you need to be able to deduce whether you should be exploiting that opportunity or not. So that's one of the reasons why you need to have a decision-making process in place. Now, the second framework that we're going to look at today is, you know, once we've made the decision to exploit a particular opportunity, how do we implement the processes? And to implement any process, you must have something which I call a delivery framework. In other words, how do I deliver the products or the services to a particular market segment? And that's what we're going to look at today. And remember, the underlying tone behind today's discussion is about opportunities. How do we exploit them? How do we make decisions around this exploitation? And how do we deliver it to the marketplace? Now, the first component we're going to look at today is around the product or service offering that you're provided. You know, have you actually identified what you should be providing from the opportunity that has been presented? Now, depending on the organization, you may already actually have these products in place. You may actually have this service in place. And all you need to do is just tailor your products and services around exploiting the opportunity that has come your way. So how do you know which product or which service you need to service this opportunity? And I've looked at various tools, and I specifically like these three tools which I'm going to discuss now, which have been beneficial to me in terms of my personal and my professional life. Now, the first tool we're going to look at is something called a BCG matrix. And BCG stands for the Boston Consulting Group. And what these guys have done is they've designed this tool, a simple tool actually, that can be adopted to decide which product line or which service or which products to invest in. And on the flip side, of which ones to dispose of or to shut down. In other words, this tool enables you to have a diversified and a balanced portfolio. So if you look at it from your from the point of view of your life, if you look at the way you use your time, certain things you should be doing and certain things you shouldn't be doing. But how do you know which ones to do and which ones not to do? Again, it's by having some form of tools. And this is what these guys have decided to do. Now, they've come up with four categories. And what they've said is that if you look at what you have to offer, if you look at the products you have to offer, if you look at the services that you're currently providing, and you've sort of benchmarked it against the opportunity that has come your way, you need to decide, because the reason is that because you've already got resources committed to service these products and service that particular service, do you currently have the resources to exploit the opportunity that has come your way? So what is going to happen is that you have to look at everything that you're doing and say which one basically has to give. So that's what the BCG matrix is all about, identifying which product or service has to give or has to be disposed of so that we can fully exploit the opportunity that has come our way. And the first thing that they've said is that if you do this assessment and you have a product or you have a service or you have a gifting, you know, which has a high market share in a fast growing market, then this is a star and you really don't want to dispose of it. This is something that you're doing that is beneficial to everyone. Hence the term high market share and a fast growing market. So if you have that in your portfolio, the best thing to do is leave the resources that are committed to exploit this particular opportunity. They also say if you've looked at your portfolio again of what you have to offer and it's in a high growing market, right? It's doing well, but you know, your influence in that market is very, very low. It's a question mark. Do I continue to commit my resources to service this particular product or service or gifting? And they said you give it a question mark. In other words, you need to do further analysis to decide whether you want to still commit your resources to exploit this particular opportunity. The third one they've come up with is something called a cash cow. And they said this is a product or a service in a market that has growing. You have a high market share. In other words, you're giving a lot of benefit in this market, but the market is maturing. It's reached its capacity, but you're still generating a lot of cash, a lot of benefit. Then it's called a cash cow. And they have advice for you to keep your resources servicing this. In other words, don't remove your resources from it. So in other words, you can't take the resources to fully exploit this new opportunity that has come your way. And the last one, and forgive me because I'm not insulting anyone, they've said it's a dog. And they've said you may have some products and you may have some services that are in a market that is declining. In other words, there's no benefit. You know, there's no benefit to your organization. There's no benefit to you as a person. And there's basically no benefit to anybody. So in other words, why are you keeping your current resources servicing that market? And they've caught it a dog, and the advice is to get rid of it. It sort of reminds me of that scripture where Jesus talks about pruning, you know, the pruning of the vine. In other words, get rid of the bits that are not beneficial. So what it's saying, to exploit any future opportunities come your way, you've got to do some form of resource assessment so that you know whether to commit or not to commit your current resources. Because sometimes your limitation may be you don't have enough people to service this particular market. So you have to basically find a way of basically balancing it in such a way that your current employees are not stressed out. So for example, if I have limited resources to invest in the servicing of a product or service, right, I can analyze it using this method called the BCG matrix. Now, what I've actually done is I've sort of come up with my own example of a BCG matrix, but I've looked at it from the point of view of the gospel. So I've said one service that we're providing in a particular market, call it Kazakhstan. I hope I've pronounced it right. So I've said one of our products or services is that we do a lot of gospel concerts. We've identified the fact that, you know, gospel concerts are on the rise. It's in a growing market, and we've been very, very effective, right, in hosting gospel concerts with a lot of people giving their lives. So I really want to still commit my resources to it because, you know, we're still benefiting from the opportunities that come our way. So I give this one a star, and I've said this, it's a star because it's a very effective asset that we're managing. So I don't want to take anyone away from it. Then I looked at another product or service we provide. Something called Lunch of Jesus. Again, we are very dominant in this field. Even though the growth in this market is a bit low, it is still effective in creating the awareness of Christ. So do I want to remove my resources? No. But I still give it a cash cow because of the benefits that it provides. I looked at another. We do a lot of church services. But the question is, yeah, a lot of people are hosting church services. It seems to be growing. But for some reason, we've not been able to draw the amount of people required to justify our status as a megachurch. So the question to this particular organization is, should we focus on other avenues of spreading the gospel? Should we form a collaborative relationship with another church to spread the gospel? So because we're sort of trying to decide what to do, we give that particular service or product that we're providing a question mark. So we're saying, yes, we still want to commit some resources to providing to servicing this opportunity, but we'll still discuss it. So we give it a question mark. And the last thing is we looked at our distribution of track strategy. Now, we looked at it and said, everything seems to be going online. It's not really a major part of our portfolio. And because everyone's going online, there may be a need to actually drop this strategy of distributing tracts. I mean, at least for our church. So that what I can now do is all the resources that we've committed to producing tracts, we can use them now to service this new opportunity that comes our way. So you get a rough idea of what we're trying to do here is to assess the commitment of our resources to the products and the services that we're currently providing. So this is what the BCG matrix does. I looked at another tool that was used, something called a product diffusion curve. Don't be taken away by the big grammar because it's another very easy tool that we probably do it subconsciously and we don't know. Now, this tool is used to assess the impact that we have when we initiate, when we launch a new initiative. It probably could be a new program in church. It could be a new conference. It could be something new, something that we've looked at and we said we want to launch this. But we have to do some form of assessment. Now, why do we have to do this assessment based on something called a product diffusion curve? It's simple. Not everyone may find this idea attractive at the same time. Hence, we need to understand the following class of people. Now, some people are what you call innovative people. They're ready to take on new ideas, new initiatives. They're risk takers. You know, they will attend. They basically want to see what the benefits they can gain. So these are innovators. They don't wait for 1 year. As long as it's new, they'll take a step of faith and they'll attend. Now, you also have people called early adopters. Now, these guys, what they tend to do is gauge the initial response of those that have attended this program or have attended this or have utilized this particular product before they even rush to attend or even before they rush to buy this particular product. Most of the time, they may be educated, but their strategy is let the innovators go first. The next set of people you have is the early majority. Now, this set of people are more cautious. They tend to be the thinkers, and they will actually prefer to avoid any risk associated with any initiative that they're not comfortable with. They generally wait for the innovators to go first, and they generally wait for the general adopters to go first. And they'll probably make a decision in 6 months' time or in a year's time after everyone has, you know, they're the typical ones that if you go to Amazon.com to buy a book and you look at the comments, you know, they're the ones, they'll read all those comments before even taking the plunge. Now, you have another group of people called the late majority. Now, these people are more skeptical. You know, they're the last ones to jump on board and do anything at all. You know, so if there's a new initiative, they will make sure that everyone has tried it before they commit. And then the last set of people are what they call the laggards. Now, members of these groups are even more skeptical. In fact, they tend not to like anything. You know, they tend to want to keep to the status quo. So in other words, if you launch any new program or any new initiatives, these are not the kind of people that jump on board at the onset. Now, from a Christian point of view, do we avoid these people? No, because God's mandate is to love everyone. We have to, in as much as we've categorized them into different categories, we still have to understand and love them. Now, the question is, why? Simple. You got to remember that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they resisted the gospel for a very, very long time before some of them started to adopt the message of the gospel. The Gentiles were more receptive, so they were like the innovators of that time or the early adopters. Now they were more receptive. Even Jesus highlighted that sometimes they could be a hindrance to following the gospel because of riches. So the question is, in our lives, with everything God has blessed us with all the resources we have, all the programs we're running in our churches, all the products, the services that we're providing to these categories of people, have we actually analyzed our programs to assess the rate of adoption of our congregation members, of those around us? Or, if not to assess the rate of adoption, to assess the lack of adoption based on the categories defined above? Because, again, it's all about the commitment of resources. And we don't want to commit too much resources to programs where people are not adopting them. And we'll talk more about that later on. Now, the last tool we're going to look at, which deals with, you know, our commitment of our resources to products we provide, services we provide, is called the product life cycle. Now, this is a tool that is used to map the different stages of a product, of a service, or even a character trait throughout its lifespan. And the typical stages are represented by the following. There's the introduction, normally categorized by, you know, as a low growth rate until the product is launched or your service is announced or you've created an awareness of it. Then you have the growth stage where the product begins to gain acceptance. Maybe a program begins to gain acceptance. If we look at the Festival of Life, when it first started, we can see the massive growth because, you know, you probably had the first set of people that attended. And, you know, as the testimonies began to spread, you know, we can see an increase to the extent that, you know, we have more resources committed. We have more people attending. And it's pretty much one of the most important strategic tool that the Redeemed Christian Church of God is adopting in London as an evangelistic tool. It's surely an asset. So in terms of committing our resources, you can see that every single Redeemed Church in London has a mandate to provide resources because it is a key strategic tool which is being used by the Redeemed Church. And it's probably becoming a franchise because we now have FOL in Scotland. We have FOL in Wales. So you can begin to understand now. The question is, if FOL was not generating the level of attendance that it is now, then then question marks could be raised as to, you know, taking away these resources and committing it to do something else. In other words, to fully exploit any other opportunities to spread the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. So that's the growth stage. Then you have the maturity stage where this, you know, it begins to stabilize, you know. Now, the maturity stage can actually be extended. So, because after the maturity stage, what tends to happen is there tends to be a decline, but you can actually prolong that decline, you know, by coming up with strategies to prolong the maturity of a product or service. Decline speaks for itself. This is when everything begins to dwindle, and then you probably have to reallocate your resources elsewhere to exploit new opportunities that come your way. Now, let me give you an example. We used to run something called Church in the Home, which was very successful at the beginning. Quite a lot of people took to it. But, you know, with the increase in the church population, questions to ponder on will be around whether you still have the resources to manage such a large program. Because we have a congregation of about probably 3,000 now. And to manage Church in the Home for 3,000 people is all about resources. So I currently know that we don't run that program now. So it could be a question or it could be an answer that we didn't have enough resources to manage the program. So you can see that rather than continuing this program, we've sort of diverted our resources to exploit other opportunities that come our way. So we have things like Christmas Lunch on Jesus. We have something which our CSR charity runs called Shoe Boxes. Now, can you imagine if we were still running something like Church in the Home and trying to service all these opportunities that come our way? You know what's going to happen. People are just going to be burnt out. Then we also ran a program called Read the Bible in a Year. Again, this lasted about a year. And based on my own understanding, I know only one person was running that. So the question is, if you can't get more resources for a program that's expanding, then you probably need to assess whether you need to continue that program or not. And remember what I stated earlier is that not every single opportunity has to be exploited. You need to focus on an opportunity whereby you have the correct decision-making framework in place and you have the proper delivery framework in place so that you can fully, and I mean fully, exploit these opportunities. How many times have we tried to exploit opportunities that we, in a way, didn't have local standing? We didn't have the framework in places. And what happened? It was just a wasted effort. So we need to understand that. Now, the second component that we're going to look at is something called the market. Because at the end of the day, if we have a product, if we have a service, if we have giftings, we're supposed to provide, or we're supposed to service this market with whatever we have. You know, we have to provide benefits and so many things. So it is important, therefore, that we understand the market that you, me, have been called to service, not what other people have been called to service. In such a case, then they become your competitors. But it's important that we understand the market. Now, again, below are some tools that help us to understand how to provide the benefits in line with what the customer wants, not what you want. Now, the first one's called something called market segmentation. Now, what is market segmentation? It's around designing a benefit system, or what marketers call a value proposition, for every market? No, for a target market. And you can design value propositions around how the product looks, the price that people are willing to pay, the quality, the design, the availability, the brand image, relationships, or the level of engagement. Now, that's around a value proposition. But also segmenting your market could be around geographical, by country or region, demographic, by age, gender, occupation, psychographic, by lifestyle, values, interest. And quite interestingly, people have said that those that come to Jesus' house, they're of a particular lifestyle, you know, particular way they look, particular way they dress. So I said to him, are you trying to say that there's some form of market segmentation in the church generally? And if you look at it, maybe there is. So the question is, if you have a program that you're designing for a particular church, the question is, do you design it around the people that would attend? So the question is, if I ran a particular program in another church, what is the probability that you're going to get a lot of people attending based on their lifestyle, based on their gender, occupation? So these are some of the things we need to take into account when we are looking at market segmentation. And the last one is behavioral. You know, what are you going to use the product for? What are the benefits that you're looking for in a product? The Bible even has examples of segmentation. It's very, very important that we understand this, because the four Gospels is another example of segmentation. You know, the Gospel reaching different people with the same product. The same product was the Gospel. And we know that Matthew had to reach the Jews. Mark had to reach the Romans. Luke had to reach the Greeks. And John, the rest of the people, the Gentiles. Why? Why didn't Jesus send Matthew to speak to the Romans? Again, that's some form of market segmentation, because at the end of the day, you have to exploit an opportunity where you provide the value proposition or the benefits that will achieve its purpose in life. In other words, that will fully exploit that opportunity. No, we're talking about identifying business opportunities. It's one thing to identify the opportunity, and that's the role of the decision-making framework. And it's another thing to exploit it. And that's why we're discussing about the delivery framework today. Now, we're going to look at something else called a customer matrix. Now, what does that do? Simple. Now, this is a tool that explores the relationship between what the user perceives as value, right, and the benefits that the customer gains from this product or this service. Because at the end of the day, what does the customer expect for the price that is being quoted? In other words, what is the customer expecting from what you have to offer? Now, we all know that people come to church for various reasons, because of the value proposition that is presented to you by the gospel. Now, let's give some examples. Salvation, freedom, healing, prosperity, deliverance, righteousness. I mean, I can go on and on. I only need to open up my Bible to probably Acts of Apostle or Romans, and you can see the various value propositions that Jesus had to offer. If you look at his mission statement where he says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to provide the following, you know, to provide, to set the captives free, to deliver the oppressed. So you can see that, you know, the reason why people come to church is because of the different value propositions that the church is providing. Why would I pay £225,000 for a Bentley when I can go into the marketplace and buy a car for £2,000? Why? Because in terms of performance, in terms of the uniqueness, in terms of the comfort and the reliability and the safety, I am willing to pay that amount. So you can see the importance of any product or service, or even you as a person, the giftings that you are giving society. What is the value proposition? What is the benefit to the market? Why are you on earth? You know, what is the legacy you're leaving behind? When people talk about you, what is the benefit that you have provided in the lives of people? So a customer matrix enables you to assess what this is. And the last one I'm going to talk about now is something called a value innovation analysis. What does the customer really value? Because once you understand what the customer values, then you can begin to eliminate certain things which you don't need. So we need to ask ourselves, and I've given an example here, again, relating to the gospel. I've said, looking at Christendom as an industry, let's just take Christendom as an industry. And the first question that we need to ask ourselves as part of this value innovation analysis is simple. What factors can be eliminated that in the industry we take it for granted? Now, there was a time that in every single church, and probably now, you see hymn books, you see publications. But the question is, in reality, everything is going online. If it's not going online, you have VDU screens, you have public address systems, you have projectors that are projecting the words of these hymns. So do we really need hymn books? Why don't we take the resources, the monetary value from these hymn books and use it to better the experience of online technology? So what we're saying is that, you know, as part of adding value, do we need so many hymn books? I'll leave you to answer that question. Another question we need to ask ourselves is, what factors can be reduced well below industry standards? As we know, the amount of conferences that we hold, there's so many. So the question is, are we having too many conferences? And what are the value propositions of these conferences? Because if they are not providing value, why don't we reduce the amount of conferences and channel the resources to exploit other opportunities that have come our way? Another question, what factors should we raise well above industry standards? And I've written a spirituality. In fact, the higher we go, the better for us, because that's the basis of our life. And the last question is, what factors should be created that the industry does not offer? And I was going to say online services, which Jesus says we've already started to do, because we're saying, you know what? It's not, you know, where two or three people are gathered together, his presence is there. If we can get two or three people in any household and project the service onto a screen, hey, you have church. So these are questions. And why do we have to constantly ask this question? It's simple. Because to fully exploit opportunities and to have the resources to service these opportunities, because there's a cost factor involved, by doing this assessment, what do? You eliminate and you reduce your cost, and you raise and create new value. The third component in this framework that we're talking about is something called goals. What are goals? Now, goals are just a general statement of aims or purpose with regards exploiting the opportunity. In most cases, these goals should align with your vision and purpose in life. Remember that these are goals that you're going to use to exploit opportunities that come your way. An example of a goal could be increase market share in three markets served by the company. Position your company as the leader in an industry. equip individuals to be influential and relevant in the global marketplace. Equip individuals to communicate the gospel as a driver for salvation in the marketplace. Now, if you look at these examples, they're just general broad statements. It does not really address how you want to achieve it, but it states the intention of what we are trying to do. So that's what goals should do. They should stress the intention. They should state the intention. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to achieve? These are what goals are. You know, they don't tell you how, but they basically tell you what you're trying to do. So that's what goals are. And we all understand, and most of us have set goals in our lives, either in the workplace or for our personal lives. And as we approach the end of another year, we should really start thinking of the goals. Now, the fourth component in this framework is about setting objectives. If goals state the intention and goals do not actually tell you how, you can only know how when you have a specific measurement or a specific parameter that you're trying to achieve. And this is where the objective comes in. And we've all heard about something called SMART. You know, it's a more precise statement of the goal that is qualified by the following. It should be significant, specific, dated, measurable, reasonable, consistent, and the last one, something that has a survival or a success factor assigned to it. So I repeat that. Your objective is not a statement of intent. It's a precise statement that has to be qualified by the following: significant, specific, dated, measurable, reasonable, consistent, and of a survival nature or success nature. And let me give you some examples. One of my objectives could be reducing my debt from 4 million by the end of the year. Reducing my debt by 3 million by the end of next year. Reducing my debt to 2.5 million by the next 2 years. It could be that. An objective could be read the whole New Testament by quarter three, 2011. You can see it's specific and measurable. And this one, not that I'm overweight, but lose 2 pounds in the next 2 weeks. You can see it's specific. It's specific. So when you are setting our goals, if you can't measure it, when setting objectives, if you can't measure it, then it's not an objective. Now, the fifth component in the framework is defining your strategies. So you've defined your goals and your objectives. Now is how am I going to get this to pass? Now that the full focus of your organization is in place, in other words, you've set up your goals and your objectives, it's now to really develop the how part of it. And your goals and objectives will be achieved through the successful implementation of these strategies. Now, when I'm talking about strategies, they tend to fall into four categories. The first one addresses managing or exploiting opportunities based on the existing products and the existing markets that you're currently serving. Or you can decide to have new products in your existing market. Or you can decide that your existing products should be exploited in new markets or new products in existing markets. And the last one is whereby you want to exploit this opportunity with new products and take it to the new market. The focus is key. Everything that we've spoken about is about focus. And that's why we have this framework in place, so that we do not go on a tangent. So you can see your strategies will normally fall into these areas. And I've got some strategies here that were adopted in the gospel. I looked at Nehemiah. And what were the strategies that Nehemiah used to exploit the opportunities that God told him to pursue? He rebuilt the wall. He assessed the damage. He secured resources. He delegated all the assignments. He chose leaders. So you can see a bit of recruitment there. You can see a bit of building strategy there. But you can see that he had a strategy. Let's look at Jesus. He had a recruitment strategy where he recruited 12 men. He had a training strategy, constantly speaking to them in parables, constantly taking them on field trips. He was a master. He used a lot of public speaking and miracles as part of his strategic portfolio. And again, the one that we thank him for is the strategic plan of redemption. Let's look at David, King David. He led Israel as the king. He chose men of Issachar who could think strategically. He chose mighty men to fight his wars. And then most of all, praise and worship in speaking to God. Let's look at the Apostle Paul, whose aim and objective was to take the gospel to the Gentiles. He went on a lot of missionary journeys. He also had a beachhead strategy because the Bible tells us that he visited every major town that was on the coastline in the Middle East. Let's look at Moses. He took the children of Israel out of Egypt. He delegated his workload based on the advice his father gave him. He sent spies to research the land. Let's look at Joshua. He led the Israelites into the promised land. He marched around Jericho 7 times, a nice strategy God gave him, very innovative strategy. And he destroyed everything in Jericho. And then God sent him a commander with instructions and strategies. This was the guy that said he needed to take his shoes off after meeting him. So you can see that, you know, even the Bible is full of strategies. Strategies are the doing, is the how. How are we going to get these things to pass? How are we going to do these things? Now, the sixth component in the framework is the application of tactics. And I always like to use football. So you've heard of the 4-4-2 tactical play or the 4-5-1 tactical play. I mean, an example could be Arsenal. And you know why I'm using Arsenal. Arsenal's goal could be the best football club in Europe. Now, that's just a goal. That's just a statement of intent. But what would the objective be? Objective could be, in order to fulfill this goal, we want to win the Champions League Cup this year. It's specific. By the end of this year, we want the Champions League Cup on our trophy. Now, that is a strategy. That's an objective. Now, what a strategy could be, our style of play will be attack. So we are going to adopt a strategic attack approach. And then we move to tactics. Now, tactics, which is the sixth component in this framework, represents the blood and sweat. You know, so in order to carry out a strategic plan, you know, it's like the nuts and bolts of strategy. What are we actually going to do? So in terms of the football example I gave, it could be a 4-4-2 tactical play or a 4-5-1 tactical play. But the important thing is that the tactical play has to support the strategy. The strategy has to support the objective, and the objective has to support the goal. It's very, very important. Let me give you some more examples. A goal could be, again, a statement of intent. Achieve profitable diversification of a company. Objective could be have in place a new division by the end of the year. The strategy could be to diversify into closely related and complementary products. You can see everything follows a certain pattern. And, you know, a possible tactic could be conduct a research study of existing markets to determine which products bring value to our customers. Let me give another one. Strategy. The saturation of the gospel on the internet. How? In other words, tactics. Tactic one, set up a blog page. Tactic two, set up a website presence. Tactic three, set up a Twitter page. And the last one, set up a Facebook presence. So you can see that it's very important that we understand that the delivery framework is about doing things, you know, not just coming up with a decision. If you come up with a decision and you don't act on that decision, then it's a wasted decision. The final component in your delivery framework is once I start implementing my objectives, my goals, my strategies, and my tactics, how do I know that they are very, very effective? You have to have some form of measure to measure it. And it's something that our people, management people, call having KPIs or critical success factors. But somebody that brought this thing to light is a statement that I read by a guy called Rick Warren. And what did Rick Warren say? Basically, anytime someone says you can't measure success by numbers, my response has been the following. It all depends on what you are counting. If you are counting marriages saved, lives transformed, broken people healed, unbelievers becoming worshippers of Jesus Christ, and members being mobilized for ministries and missions, numbers are extremely important. Let me read that again. Anytime someone says to me, you can't measure the success of your organization by numbers, my response has been, it all depends on what you're counting. If you are counting marriages saved, lives that have been transformed, the life of broken people being healed, unbelievers becoming worshippers of Jesus, and members being mobilized for ministries and mission, numbers are extremely important. What he was trying to say is that it's not about the number of people you have in the church. You can have a church of 10,000 people, and you can have a church of 500 people. But if you count these critical success factors, then numbers are important. If the numbers of these factors are low, then your church is not effective. So it basically was saying it's not about numbers. So he's come up with something called the balanced scorecard. In other words, he's adopted the balanced scorecard in the following areas. He's called the first one called "How do I measure the financial fruitfulness of my church?" And he said we have to look at it from the perspective of always magnifying the name of our Father in heaven. He says, how do I fulfill the customer perspective? How do I ensure that our strategies for customer perspective are effective? By having discipleship and fellowship programs. How do I maintain the proper balance internally in my organization? He said, by ensuring that relationships are developed, innovative programs are developed in the church, our facilities are excellent, and our development programs are excellent. And the final one is, how do I make sure that my church is on at the spearhead of technology and innovation? Is by ensuring that my staff, my volunteers, my leadership, the culture and the resources of the organization are constantly monitored and improved. Then we can determine success in my church. So the question is, in our lives, how do we know everything we're doing is effective? How do we know everything we're doing is generating resources? How do we know that when it's time to go, that we've left a legacy based on a value proposition that is meeting the needs of people? I really hope you've enjoyed today. But most importantly, as you can see, identifying business opportunities has to be structured. Because first of all, when opportunities come our way, they don't come in a structured format. So you need to have some form of structure in your place so that you can fully exploit these opportunities. I hope you've been blessed. And I look forward to our session next week. God bless and have a wonderful week.
We end this episode with some take-home points from the concluding discussions held on the frameworks required in identifying business opportunities. Number one, the value proposition of business opportunities should be supported by the products and services that are delivered to the client or the customer base. Number two, the relevance and profitability of the products and services delivered to the client or the customer base should be reviewed periodically. Number three, based on the outcome of the review, the allocation of resources to the existing portfolio of products and services can be adjusted. Number four, the delivery framework should be supported by goals which are concise statements on what the business opportunity should accomplish. Number five, objectives are a further breakdown of the established goals with more defined accountable parameters. Number six, strategies are defined plans for achieving the defined objectives of the business opportunities. Number seven, tactics can be defined as the nuts and bolts for supporting and implementing the strategies. And number eight, key performance indicators qualify and quantify how effective the delivery and decision framework were in channeling the products and services of the business opportunities to the customer or client base. My name is Tunike Akinbulamo. Goodbye and God bless.